This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, welcome back to another episode of Parker's Pensies. I'm your host, Parker Sedekase, and this is a podcast where we explore all the deepest ideas in philosophy, theology, nature, and life. I love thinking about cool stuff, so come think with me. Today's episode is very, very special. I have with me Dr. Luciano Floridi. We're going to be talking about information, which is really fun, the philosophy of information. He is a pioneer. I think he's invented the philosophy of information in a sense. In a sense, it's always been here the whole time. That's one of his arguments as well. It's really cool. You guys can check out his short little book, Information, A Very Short Introduction. He's got a lot of other books, but this is a great intro to it. I've been blessed by it as well. Today, we're going to be talking about information, maybe some AI, but just what is information? That's going to be a really fun one. Before we jump in, I want to thank everyone who's making this podcast happen over on Patreon. If you guys like the show, support it on Patreon or YouTube members. This episode's also brought to you by Saddleback Leather. You guys know I love Saddleback Leather stuff. Look in the description for the link to Saddleback. I have it all over my office. It's amazing stuff. I love it. Check them out. And if you use my link, then you'll support the podcast. So please do that. No, not too much commodification today because I want to jump in with Dr. Floridi. So let's just pull him right in. Dr. Floridi, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
Before we get in, so I pronounce the podcast incorrectly, and I do that intentionally because I'm an American swine, and I think it'd be a little pretentious if I just jumped in from my Chicago accent to Pensée. But also, my last name is Italian. My grandfather was Sicilian, but my dad was adopted by him. He's Italian. You're Italian. Can you pronounce my last name for me? Can you help us with this?
So, Parker, I need to find your surname first of all. But
yeah, it's right down in the picture.
There it is. Sette case.
There we go.
It means seven houses.
Yeah, that's right. Can you do it one more time for me?
Okay, here we go. That's why the invitation. I can see that. Okay, sette case.
Oh, it's beautiful. That's so good. Thank you. Well, Dr. Floridi, you spent. Like half of your academic life as a logic guy, mathematical logic. And I just realized, I was listening to one of your interviews and you said or maybe I was looking up your info about you and you studied with Susan Hack. Is that right?
I did. Yes.
So her book, Philosophy of Logic, is like epic. So wonderful. Life-changing for me a while back when I was in seminary. Beautiful. Amazing. You got in through logic and somehow you became the information guy. Can you help us with that? How'd that happen?
Yeah, so that book was at the time was translated into Italian. At the time, I didn't have any English. That's embarrassing. So I was a first year student undergraduate, and my English was like, you know, I could hardly hold the aircon. So I read that accidentally. It was not part of any course, but you know the usual curious, investigative undergrad who wants to know more about this and that. Just came out, it just made a revolution in my way of thinking. There were two books. One actually was a set book for a course on Introduction to Ethics, which was Ethics by E.G. Moore. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, I discovered this world of analytic philosophy where you could actually talk about problems, mm-hmm. not about people. Well, that is not entirely true because then analytic philosophy became mostly about Russell, Wittgenstein, and Frege. But it's the destiny of any, you know, philosophical trend. You start with the philosophy of problems and then you end with philosophers' problems. But at the time, we, shall we say, the community of early stage career, little guy, me, and other big names, we were still dealing with philosophical problems. And both from the ethics side, you know, E.G. Moore, and from the logic and philosophical logic, Susan, it was fascinating how you could have remarkable, clear, and precise tools to tackle issues that you thought were interesting, important. So that was the beginning. I wrote a letter with a stamp to Susan, who was at Warwick, and I started a little conversation with her. Then I got a scholarship from Rome University to go and work with her and Michael Dummett at Warwick and Oxford. And what was a 6 months write your undergrad thesis abroad kind of project, what finds me now at Yale. So no, I never left, basically.
Wow.
But it was fascinating. But you asked, actually, sorry, the question, how did I move from there to...
Yeah.
Well, the thing, we need to introduce a third character who is not just E.G. Moore and Susan Hack, but Popper, Karl Popper.
Yeah.
I got lucky again. Popper was still alive. I was retired. I was writing some philosophical stuff on his work. And I, again, as a graduate student would, I wrote the usual letter with a stamp and said, "Dear Sir Carl," unbelievable. He actually replied. So we had this very quick conversation. I cherish that letter. I must have that particular letter, in which he disagreed completely with me. But that's another story of this. But, you know, you're a graduate student, and there is no Karl Popper disagreeing with you. Like, you think you are really, you know, part of the club. Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And so I'm introducing him because there's a particular, not terribly well-known, but remarkably important article by Popper, which is, if I remember correctly, long time, epistemology without the knowing subject.
Hmm.
And in this article, it speaks about, you know, how you can do, you know, to your knowledge, epistemology, you know, from what I would consider, Popper would have been horrified, but an analytic sort of perspective, in terms of looking at just the knowledge itself. I mean, the dynamics of knowledge, the distribution of knowledge, what we in other concept would be called sort of epistemic logic approach to it. Yeah. So you start seeing the pieces, and then all of a sudden I realized, actually, this thing is not called knowledge because it's not owned by us, it's called information. Mm. If you start talking about something out there that I may or may not have, I may or may not send, I may or may not sort of shape, the stuff there of which knowledge is made, I thought, well, this really is information. And then click with the last element in this conversation, which is a bit personal. Oh, Parker, yeah. Am I allowed?
Yeah, please, please.
Yeah. Originally, a long, long, long time ago, but we talked about Luciano in his teenager, because we studied philosophy in high school. My primary interest was philosophy of religion, Kierkegaard in particular. But what I was interested in the first year of my undergraduate studies, the reason why I wanted to study more about logic and philosophy of logic and communication theory and so on, I was interested in the in how things that today I'm no longer sort of able to say without smiling, how God can send a message to humanity.
Yeah.
No, the angel, not the angelos, not the messenger, etc.
Right.
And so I was interested in understanding from a canon perspective, believe it or not, God's communication with humanity, not thinking God is a source, humanity is the receiver, and there is a channel. How this channel could work, if it works at all, in order to sort of present a message, the good message, you know, the New Testament, it has the Evangelos, you know, has the same root as
The Evangelion. Yeah.
So all that was classic studies to do for you. So put all these pieces together, and then now there's an interesting source and receiver that from a philosophy of religion, miracles, etc. Then there's Popper, epistemology without knowing subject. Then there's E.G. Moore and analytic philosophy. There's the philosophy of logic. And so one day, and that's the end of the story, I was at Wolfson College in Oxford, I was a postdoc at that point, and I was invited to give a talk in London, open topic. And I really wanted to do something about this stuff that we wouldn't be known afterwards as philosophy of information.
Yeah.
And I was with someone. There's someone, I don't remember her name at all. That's shame on me. That's the philosopher in typical, like totally folk. I must have bored that poor girl to death. Sitting on the this little bench, looking at the river, Wilson College, and I said, you know what? I could call this, I could give a talk called What is the Philosophy of Information? There is no such thing, but I think we should have it. And the next thing I know, they say, oh, yeah, that's interesting. Why don't you come and give me this talk? What is it? Like, what? Well, we can discover it together. That's the beginning.
That's fantastic. That's so cool. My audience will love that story, too, especially about Kierkegaard or Kierkegaard. We have a lot of Kierkegaardians in the audience, so that'll be fun. It's really fascinating that you wanted to use Shannon information to talk about divine revelation. I think that's really fascinating. Yeah,
and maybe I know. You've come a
long
time.
Way. Yeah, you've come a long way since then, but that's super fascinating.
Sooner or later, I'll go back to that question, though. That is my long, long, long journey.
Oh,
at some point, I would go back all the way to the question about God. That is the question.
Yeah. Dr. Floridi, maybe this is too personal, but have you when you were talking or when you were thinking about that project, were you a believer in God yourself are you not any longer?
No longer. So when I lost my faith roughly at that stage during the second year, it is a 4-year course. And during the second year, I realized that I had lost it.
Okay. Yeah.
It's not that the one day you wake up and say, oh, I don't have faith anymore. Mm. But it's like the foundations of a building.
Sure.
It gets eroded and eroded and eroded. And one day, boom, the whole thing collapses. But that was not the day when it really was undermined. It was like a long
process. Yeah.
I would say being a late teenager, by the time I was 17, 18, I had already almost lost entirely my faith. Having said that, I didn't acquire another faith. I never became an atheist.
Okay.
I didn't want to exchange one belief for another belief. People know, you don't go around. There's a famous phrase, in philosophy of science that absence of evidence is not evidence of sound absence.
Right.
And if you are rigorous enough and serious enough, you should acknowledge that. And we may never know. So I describe myself today as a spiritual agnostic.
Mm, okay.
That's as close as it gets. Yeah.
That's fascinating. Well, yeah. Thanks for that personal detail. That's really fascinating. I hate to do this to you because everyone does, but you kind of, since you invented the philosophy of information, it comes with a territory. Can you help us out? Like what is information? There's a bunch of different ways to categorize it. Is there one central core that picks out, what information is across different definitions?
Well, first of all, let's say it's a mess. That's the number one.
Okay.
Everybody should start from there because I've seen people talking about information as if using it most of the time, especially in philosophy, as if it were like the most obvious tool, and therefore everybody understands me, and all that. So, and then that is where the confusion starts, because of course there are many ways in which we understand what information is. They have in common something, and I'll tell you more in a moment. But let me start from since you mentioned the little book, I don't feel guilty in telling people that it's all in that little book.
Yeah.
And very short introduction. So imagine you're talking about information in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be, say, the traces left by an animal in the forest. It could be the usual rings of a tree cut, telling you the age of that tree. So that is, shall we say, the ontological conception of information. And that, when we speak about that, we might be even talking about, since there's been a revival of LPs, the trace that is read by the pin to reproduce music. I mean, that is also a physical trace. And you can point to it like, that is information. Say, in one sense, it's a pattern. So a lot of people often say, well, look, what we have here is information because there's a pattern that, and now we move to a different concept. They're all related, okay?
Yeah.
That pattern may have meaning. It's not just a random pattern. It's not like, clouds in the sky.
Sure.
That pattern, for example, the pattern on an LP, the engraved pattern read by the pin or my fingertip. Fingerprint, sorry, left on a glass, etc.
Yeah.
They have meaning. They might have consequences, etc. When we talk about meaningful patterns, then we start talking about meaningful data, and that is already entering into the realm of semantic information. So you're no longer just talking about, there's a particular structure or pattern out there, but you're talking about information about something. So it's no longer information as something, but information about something. That is the usual meaning that we tend to endorse if we're talking information. But, I want to have some information, or information desk, or I didn't get any information. Information these days is everything. You can't take decisions without information. That's what we mean. Content about something else. So there's a referent and there's content. Content doesn't help if you don't describe that. Becomes data plus meaning plus syntax.
Yeah.
So the data have a particular structure and they have a particular. If you move all the way to adding also a true value, that it's false or not, then you have one kind of semantic information, which is the typical factual semantic information that you find in Wikipedia, train, table, sort of information, so on. There's a third kind, which doesn't have a true value, which has a meaning, has a structure, which has semantic and syntax, but doesn't have any truth value, and is all the third kind information that we describe as information for something. Imagine music, files. I send you a file, I send you some information in one sense. I send an amount of data, which have particular, meaning, a particular structure, might have been zipped or not, etc. But then you open it, and does it play music? Well, that is information for something in order to play music.
Right.
Is it a recipe for a cake?
Yeah.
Okay, that is information for something. It's an algorithm. You get the gist.
But it's not necessarily vertical or not. You wouldn't say, is this a true recipe?
Is it true or false?
Yeah. Right.
So people, we use true meaning genuine at that, but not philosophy.
Yeah,
right. Is it really your true grandma's recipe? Is that genuine one?
Yes.
If we are careful. So information as something in the world, information about something, semantic, factual, and information for something, which is more the algorithmic kind. Once you have these three, that's a big step forward in terms of understanding what we're talking.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, and some other, so information in the book, it's information as reality, information for, information about reality, exactly. Or for the world. I love this distinction. It's been really helpful for me in thinking about getting clear, because a lot of people will conflate these, especially on the more popular level, and then say like, well, everything just is information, but they mean information about reality. It's that type of information. Everything is that. I wonder if all information, I don't know another word to say except for like intentionality. The information about reality has a particular intentionality. It's this information is about whatever thing is out there in the world. Maybe it's like representational. When I think of information as reality, and I think about either fingerprints or rings on a tree, is there an intentionality to that type of information? Like the rings in the tree, is that about the age of the tree or anything?
No, not really. There's a correlation that we can exploit.
Okay.
So we can correlate something in the world, say A has a particular feature F, and which is correlated to something else, B, having another feature G, you say. And so if you, that particular, the tree cut has not that feature, those rings, which is correlated to the same tree having a particular age. But that correlation is what we exploit in terms of then acquiring the information about the tree. It would be a little bit funny, but let me put it this way, to say, oh, the tree meant to send us a message. I know. Now imagine that you have some unknown ancient land that you discover on an island, undiscovered island tomorrow, and a dead civilization, but we find signs that have clearly a structure. That is the first hallmark of information.
Yeah.
This thing repeats, it has a regularity, things come with that syntax. You see the syntax, you actually see the patterns. You start thinking, these patterns are not natural. They have been put there by someone. You infer that there must be a meaning, a semantics. They are sending us a message, or they are sending a message. They're broadcasting a message. You need to crack that particular sort of code.
Right.
Oh, we need to be careful. Sometimes we'll be too metaphorical and say, oh, the rings in the tree is a code for metaphors. Let's be careful. The tree doesn't say anything, doesn't want to tell us anything. This is also useful when it comes to AI. No matter what you get, it is still patterns. AI didn't mean to say anything, didn't have a plan, didn't have an intention. It's just that, with all those correlations, on this side, you can tell the age of the tree. But don't confuse the tree and its intentionality with what we do with that pattern.
That's really helpful. So in diving down on that point a little bit deeper, I posted about having a conversation with you, and I just mentioned environmental information kind of to gin up interest in the conversation, and a philosopher of science was I would say she was triggered. She was like, well, dendrochronologists have to do so much work to derive the information out of the tree rings, and so tree rings are not identical to information. And in my head, I'm thinking, the whole, I go in for John Searle's observer relativity argument. So I like that. I think there needs to be an observer to be able to interpret the information. Like you said, the tree doesn't have its own intentionality, but it seems like the whole idea of dendrochronology, of finding the age of a tree from tree rings, presupposes that there is information in there to be correlated, at least, right?
You could put it the other way around. It goes around until you find something that is such that the correlation helps us to do it. I mean, it might have done not science fiction. It might have turned out that not those rings don't tell anything about the age. I mean, there is something, of course, about all the identity of the individual. I mean, not with the fingerprints. The tree had that structure because by living in a particular environment, etc., accumulates those particular features that are slowly sedimenting into its sort of particular rings. So there is a direct correlation between age and time, if you like, of growth, rings growing, and us being able to, as it were, reverse engineer the rings back to the age.
Right.
So it's not magic. There's nothing strange. But we could imagine, for example, it's a little bit like reading in archaeology, reading a particular site and the strata of the archaeological strata, and say, this belongs to, say, this particular age of humanity, and then, it's like many thousand years old set, and this was like 10,000 years, then it's 6,000 years. Why? Oh, well, because those are the artifacts. Those are the particular, say, geological events that enable us to date. So there is something there that helps us to acquire the information about the... It is tricky, and that's why we find so much confusion, because people... Because we use information as reality, almost as if the information were there and just needed to be discovered.
Yeah.
As if we were digging out the information from there. We confuse this with, imagine a different example, a radio sending a signal from, imagine we receive a radio signal from another galaxy. Mm-hmm. Has been traveling, for millions of years, and their civilization is dead. I mean, that's not science fiction. I mean, that could happen.
Totally.
Way more than other things. We cannot travel faster than light, but we could receive one day. That would be astonishing. I mean, would it be a change in human history? But imagine that we get that radio signal. That reconstruction is completely different. That is not reading ring trees or finding my fingerprints on a glass. Yeah. Someone somewhere broadcasted that. And so there's a, then we're back to the real thing, you know, to the source, the message and the receiver. That is much more Shannon. Mm. But the tree is not sending anything. We are able to interpret that particular pattern in such a way that we can sort of leverage the pattern to reconstruct backwards the age of the tree, or for example, the presence of, say, someone on a crime scene, because to some extent, the fingerprints were there. And then, of course, Sherlock Holmes shows that, no, he wasn't there, it was someone else. Someone put the glass there, the guy, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, Dr. Flaherty, I wonder if the situation changes if I leave my fingerprint on a glass with the intention of leaving my unique fingerprint. So maybe I'm kidnapped, but I press it on there so that someone can find this and say, oh, Parker's been here. Does that change the information from like environmental to, I don't know, like analog, or to, does it have intentionality now because I've intended to communicate through my unique fingerprint?
Yes. So what we have changed, and I think you find that also in the little book, we have changed, if you like, the interface through which we're looking at that piece of information. In computer science, it's called level of abstraction, but we don't have to be sort of too fancy. I mean, we can call it interface. So if you're looking, for example, at a, with an interface of the police looking for someone who might have been kidnapped, or say, I'm lost in a forest and I start leaving pieces of my clothes here.
Yeah.
Imagine that scenario versus I'm in a forest and I'm losing bits of my stuff. No, my Let me do it. Like more intelligent. My backpack. I have a backpack. There's a hole. I'm losing pieces in a forest. I'm in a forest. I'm lost. I'm trying to be found. So I'm intentionally leaving pieces in the forest. From an interface that doesn't have, why am I asking this question for? Doesn't have a purpose. The two phenomena are identical. Essentially, all I know is that someone is in the park and is leaving, and there's the remnants, you know, bits of the backpack left. Is he meant to be found? Is he lost? Does he just have a hole in the backpack and losing stuff as he goes? That is intentional. That is what we do in terms of interpretation, which is good. But we need to be able to distinguish this from what do we have in front of us. Now, sometimes, and I hope I'm not confusing things too much. Now, in philosophy of science, we speak of how data underdetermine the theory.
Yeah.
In other words, you can have many, many data points and you can reconstruct sometimes those data points in more than one way, often. Yeah. Well, that's the same story about me losing bits of stuff in the park. Am I trying to be found or just have a hole in my backpack?
Yes.
So, of course, if the police thinks that I'm lost, etc., everybody will interpret that as an attempt to be found. But it might be just an accident. I just got lucky. And without me knowing, I left a trace and people find me. Fantastic.
That's helpful. So so I understand. I think I understand information, if you want to analyze it in terms of data and meaning, because then we can go in on data and we can say, well, data are made of bits, which is just like one unit. And I understand that in the binary conversation. I'm not sure I understand it in a physical information as reality understanding. What would a bit be in the physical world?
Yeah. Oh no. Well. First of all, the bit normally. That's again an unfortunate, difficult word to use. Can either be part of the code we use in order to code some information.
Oh, sure.
So imagine like the telegraph. No. Dot line. Dot line. Dot line. So is the world the Hamlet made of dot? No, of course not. But we can transform the whole Hamlet into and transmit this on the other side of the Atlantic. No, good old days. So the bit is a code, or very rarely is something you find in the world. I mean, the world doesn't tend to be binary the way we experience it. We normally experience it as a continuum. Analog, as in, you know, there's always something in between something else. There was this famous phrase, nature doesn't make jumps. The fact that it doesn't make jumps means, you know, if you translate it into 21st century, nature is not binary. It doesn't move from zero to one or from yes, no, high, low, so current electricity in the circuit, whole or no whole on a CB, etc. So if we are not talking about the code, but we're talking about the sort of information, if you like, in reality, out there as reality, that normally is analog. Imagine a map. Okay. So you have a map. That map is continuous. It's all lines and say the underground map so that you can travel from one point to the next. The extraordinary revolution that we have undergone, if we want to have a hero, we can pick up Alan Turing, but no, it comes earlier, Babbage, but even Leibniz, Hobbes, is that we found a way of encoding every kind of information in the world, waves including, so continuum, into discrete elements, that's your code, and we have machines that can handle the code automatically. In fact, today we have machines that not only can handle the code automatically, but they can do so by learning from their app. And that's not AI. Their evolution has been extraordinary because at that point, in a few steps, which are not historically amazing, you have from the analog continuous world to the digital, not binary world, to a machine that can handle that efficiently, more and more and more, to the extent that that machine, through statistics, can also find the fundamental patterns in the original analog, imagine English or the English spoken, and start digging up from the deepest well of structures in that language, patterns that can be reused for us to do useful work. Mm-hmm. For example, translate this into that. Well, that is not a journey. That has been almost a miracle. Now, if you pass me the dangerous analogy. To me, that is really extraordinary journey from the first computer to ChatGPT.
Yeah.
Thinking about, we are creating some kind of form of intelligence, that is almost like not getting how big the transformation is. Mm-hmm. It's almost like saying, like, you are belittling the extraordinary human ingenuity that went into all these steps. And instead, you think that by clicking something that you're not quite sure, these black boxes, all of a sudden, boom, intelligence arises. It's not the way it works.
That's amazing. Okay. I've never thought of it that way. I was listening to you earlier and you talked about Now everything clicks for me, where you're saying the thing about AI is from one of your lectures is that we no longer have to use intelligence to park a car for, self-driving cars or to play chess. And that is a really big deal. It's outmoded intelligence, and that's huge. That shows how intelligent we are, that we're able to do that. But when you say, no, that thing has to be intelligent because it's doing what we do, now you've actually belittled the achievement of the programmers and such.
Exactly. If you think in terms of extraordinary, remarkable, powerful, benign or not intelligence, you belong to the past. You're still a modern, in a bad sense of modern, there's a good sense, but in a bad sense of modern thinker, you're still stuck with Frankenstein. Mm-hmm. The reproduction of ourselves, one way or another, they may or may not take over, may be not, may or may not. But the Frankenstein, the golem myth, that is not quite getting the way more, seems to me, interesting revolution, which is extraordinary. And one way of putting it, as you said, is to, for the first time in human history, we have been able to decouple successful agency and intelligence.
Yeah,
that's never happened before. I mean, we had never managed to do something successfully in view of a goal, improving at zero intelligence. So that's what I normally tell students here, is that, look, imagine parking a car at zero intelligence. Don't do that with with your parents' cat. They will not be pleased. Or imagine cooking at zero intelligence, or doing the dishes at zero intelligence, playing chess at zero intelligence. But warehousing at zero intelligence, okay? Collecting strawberries. I'm actually referring to actual industrial applications. Building a car at zero intelligence. Impossible. The mess, the disaster, the cost will be all over the place. Today we have, as we speak, not like, oh, one day. For years now, we have had machines that can do that successfully and improving because, of course, they learn from their output to get their output as an input in, so that their performance gets better and better up to a point where we are not completely satisfied. I mean, the parking is perfect. The strawberries are collected in the most efficient and effective way, etc.
Yeah.
That divorce between agency and intelligence, that is historical, and allow me for this extra little look into the future. That is where the problems are. The challenges, the opportunities, but also the problems. Now, when we talk about the ethics of AI, the real point here is in that sort of gap between agency and intelligence that we are generating and increasing, in that gap, you find all the difficulties. The privacy, the bias, the copyright and intellectual property, the control over resources, the exploitation. Keep going. The fake, deep fake, exactly. It's all there. In the fact that we can actually, for the past few years, we've been able to do things remarkably successfully, more and more at zero intelligence. That is the thing that we should be understanding much better and design much better.
Yeah, that's so fascinating. I've been thinking, I'm in a class right now on the philosophy of artificial intelligence, and I've been thinking about trying to come up with some kind of distinction, because I know that the AI folks over on the computer science side of things, they don't like the word artificial intelligence because they think it's genuine intelligence. And I think it's perfect. It's a perfect word. It is artificial. It's a representation of the intentions of the programmer. But I wonder if you would put like booby traps in the same category as like a self-driving car. Like, you know, think back to maybe a Bronze Age booby trap. Someone steps on this, something and a dart shoots into their chest. Is that still agency without intelligence in the same way, just a more rudimentary form or no?
No. So this is also another topic where we need a few distinctions. But the kind of artificial intelligence that we have, and we have had it for a while, but this one is the sort of statistical kind, as opposed to the deductive kind that we had in the past. Uh-huh. It's way more powerful. It's the ability to learn. That is the kind of agency we're talking about.
That's right.
The booby trap doesn't learn. Yeah. It's the same way in which an earthquake is a form of agency, but not the kind that we're talking about, because an earthquake doesn't learn. It's not that today you say, oh, no, I'm really an evil force. I want to do more damage. Next time I do a better job. I wait for everybody to sleep, and then I go. So, of course not. But if you think of, imagine forms of agency, and this is, for anyone who's listening, this is completely unorthodox. Don't try this at home. I've been criticized. In fact, one of the reviewers of The Ethics of AI, the last book that I published for UP, when I make this distinction, said that this was complete bonkers. So luckily I had enough replies to say that they hadn't quite understood what I was talking about. But here we go. So unorthodox. Imagine agency coming in degrees.
Okay.
Something very, very poor. Not like low degree, high degree. The highest degree is probably the one that is omnipotent. No. Imagine God. That can do anything, learn anything, know anything. But it could go for a moment. And on this planet, what we have is interaction with the world. If you make a difference in the world, then you are already an agent.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we talk about atmospheric agents for that reason.
Yeah.
Rain, earthquake, a river that goes from the mountain all the way to the sea is an agent. For good or bad, because it has one condition, the minimal condition makes a difference in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Change, so interaction. Then you have good old days, something in between, that are your average animal. say, a dog. A dog can learn. It can also have intentions. You know, it means to survive, for example. It will stay away from danger. It will not like another bigger dog coming. As that. So there's both learning and, let's call it, intentionality.
Okay.
And of course, the highest degree of that is the human being, where there is all this and the ability to overcome all this. Not only all this, but also, say, the conscious ability to control all this and say, you know what? I want to commit suicide. The dog will not. Or, you know what? I don't have to be afraid of something. Or, you know what? I can keep my hand, my finger for 30 seconds on the flame of a candle. How many stupid jokes have we done when we were kids? Like, because I want to. A dog. So that kind of conscious control, et cetera, that comes as an extra form of agency.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these were the three. No, the river, the dog, and me. And that's life on planet Earth since we came out of the caves. Today, there is a fourth player. Mm-hmm. Something that is not like the river, only because he's interactive, but he can learn. It's not like the dog because it doesn't have intention. It's not like I'm going to say, oh, no, I don't feel like eating this today. I bark because I want to go out for a walk. Okay. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't have that intentionality and certainly doesn't have the conscious self-control planning. In 2 years, I want to go and explore the Amazonian river, etc. So there's a fourth kind of agency here, which we have encountered in the past, for which we don't have conceptual tools up to it. What happens? That some people will think of this just as another form of agency interaction. It's a tool. It's no more than, say, a drill, okay? It's no more than a car. The river kind of agency. It does what it does. I control it. Bad idea. At least my old car, no, the new one learns, but the old one didn't learn. I said,
right.
I said, oh no, it's a new form. It's almost like a dog. You know, it's growing. It has it's like a 5 year old child, etc. The technology, the science we have should be good enough to tell us that at least admit that this is not the case today. I think it's bongos anyway, but no,
sure.
We're talking about my iPhone. Okay. Or we're talking about ChatGPT. It's certainly not like us. So we need to admit that we have a new player, that the game has become a little bit more complicated. We build it, we control it, or at least we have the responsibility of controlling it. We can turn it on and off. It can do things that are amazing. It can learn from its own performance. It's not like a river. It's not like a dog. It's not like a human being. What we need is a bit of work from philosophers understanding this new form of agency. That is the opening that I would find exciting. Any researcher listening to this, I mean, you have an amazing topic in your hands. Yeah. This is the 21st century. If you try to reduce this form of agency to, oh, but really some kind of intelligent, just not wider, you're just stuck with I don't want to admit that something entirely new has really happened. I have an old model. My hermeneutics is still modern and all I have are these three categories. So it has to be one, two, or three. Since it's not a river and it's not like a, it must be either like a dog or like a human being.
Yeah.
Open up.
Yeah.
Think in terms of welcome to a fourth kind. And it's perfectly reasonable. I mean, we engineer this problem solving, task caring artifacts.
The even the question of agency is so tough to think about, and it puts an exclamation point on your idea that we need to have better concepts for this new thing. Because I'm thinking maybe there's some literature on group agency, and so is ChatGPT like a group agent? Because I'm interacting with 3.5, but there's also 4. What's the connection between those two? And also if I'm using it at the same time you are, does it make sense to even call it like an agent? You know what I mean? Like we don't want to say it's intelligent, but I think the AI folks say, well, intelligence is a functional concept and it's just, solving puzzles.
Yeah.
So
how do we think of that? So about intelligence, at some point, if it becomes just a matter of vocabulary, I'm happy with any vocabulary. I mean,
okay.
You could call it a genius as far as I'm concern. I don't care. Sure. The question is what that the consequences of that choice of vocabulary. Because, for example, if then you start getting worried that it might take over the universe and dominate, well, that's silly. Okay. But if I call, say, this pen intelligent, because, you know, the more I use it, the less ink I can see here. That's very intelligent.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. So as of tomorrow, not this intelligent pen, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And a lot of that is advertisement, is hype, is selling the product. So let's be a bit more philosophical about it.
Yeah.
We want to be careful about the words because the words have consequences. They have implications. And intelligence, although we don't have a definition, and by the way, for anyone curious, just look around and see how many disciplines have defined in how many ways
so
intelligence.
Hard. Yeah.
It's a joke.
Yeah.
So the real question becomes, if we don't have a definition for intelligence, what are we talking about? Well, we do have some criteria. And you want to know whether these criteria are here being deployed or not. For example, stop playing a game because something else is more important all of a sudden. Hmm. You're playing chess with a computer, computer's winning or you're winning, so it doesn't matter. But at some point, you actually stop because maybe the fire alarm goes on. So, go. The computer will keep playing. It will win the game and burn with the house.
Yeah.
So intelligence, for example, is also a matter of flexibility. There is social intelligence. There's musical intelligence. There's that intuitive intelligence that lets you sort of postpone some news to a friend because today is not the right day. So normally when people ask me, so what is intelligence? Intelligence is is the counterpart of all the forms of stupidity that we can have today. If it was stupid, to leave the passport at home when you're flying, it would have been intelligent to take the passport before you're flying. If it is stupid to leave the finger in the door when you close the door of your car, that was stupid, yes. So it would have been intelligent not to leave the finger. If it is stupid to think that 2 + 2 = 22, then it's intelligent to think that 2 + 2 = 4. If it was stupid to say that thing to their friend, today, really, Parker, don't you know? Laura, I said, John, I said, terrible day. You could have, that was stupid. It would have been intelligent not to. You read the newspaper, you can't summarize it. Really? Oh, that's stupid. Like, intelligence not to read the newspaper. But then, the variety of things that we call intelligent is almost boundless.
Yeah.
Because it's another way of saying being human, having a successful mental life. And that is not something you can pinpoint like a definition like water equal H2O, because that is science and it's good science. But that's when we have irregimented vocabularies that can handle concepts that are clear and precise.
Mm.
In this case, we have an archipelago of islands. You can call the archipelago Maldives, but no island is the Maldives.
Mm.
And that would be silly. It's the whole archipelago. And people say, I'm kind of getting it. Let me give you another analogy. It's like people looking for the border between Italy and France. Is it in France or is it in Italy? It's a border. but it has to be somewhere. No, it's what makes one different from the other. It's that line that is neither here nor there, because if you pass it, you are in one place and you don't. So you need to be a little bit more intelligent, flexible mentally. And then the whole question, is this machine intelligent or not, becomes either trivial or misformulated. Trivial, because depends on what you mean by intelligent. If, for example, it runs calculations, well, my pocket calculator is intelligent. It can do maths like no one else, So amazing.
Yeah.
It's misformulated because we don't have that archipelago doesn't apply at all. It's comparing oranges and apples.
Yeah.
I find most of the discussion about the philosophy of AI of that kind, either trivial or pointless.
That's fascinating. I think that your three main ways of talking about information are super helpful. I haven't seen them used a lot in AI conversations, but maybe that's, it would tamp down a lot of the hype as well, because you're saying like, no, you're mixing categories. You're saying you're talking about information for reality in these algorithms as if it were information as reality, or, you know, or something else. You're mixing categories.
Exactly.
I wonder.
That's very well put. No, mixing those categories generates confusion to no end and worries about something that honestly is like zombies.
Yeah.
I'm not worried about zombies. I'm not worried about AI in the sense of zombies. I'm worried about humans using AI a lot.
Right. Yeah. And it's just straight up equivocation. This is a helpful tool for showing that we're equivocating on the term intelligence, maybe, or AI. I wonder, I want to get into some of the goofy stuff, the more out there type stuff. I think you can actually help me a lot with thinking about the extended mind thesis of Chalmers and Clark. So you talked about Karl Popper's paper, Epistemology Without the Knowing Subject, and how you thought, actually, that's not knowledge, that's information. I wonder, are our thoughts in my mind right now, whatever the mind is, are they more analog or digital? Are they more like a record or more like a CD? And then I have some following questions after that.
So, of course, the brain is an analog engine, not least because everything works in terms of how much blood it gets or not at the end of the day. And there's a lot that can be represented and was represented a lot in the past as digital in terms of neurons. They fire, they don't fire. Yes. However, now we discover, for example, that there are waves of firing.
Mm.
That determine also our neurological life processes. So in a way, it's a little bit like asking whether music is digital or analog.
Mm.
These are two codes, and you can encode music as analog and digital. Every time you do that, you may or may not lose something. It may be lost less, or it may be lossy. You may actually keep translating, and at the end, it's almost unrecognizable. But, you must have seen this experiment run actually by my wife is a neuroscientist. She's a professor of neuroscience. She was a chair of neuroscience in Oxford, and we came together to Yale, and she's now the director of the neuroscience center here at Yale and professor of neuroscience. And a friend of ours, a friend of hers in particular, a friend of mine, by proxy, the University of Berkeley, they ran this experiment and they tried to reconstruct what people were listening to by looking, and then it turned out there was the wall of Pink Floyd. I don't know if you have actually heard, listened to it. They had to tell you that it's Pink Floyd, because okay, it's barely recognizable, but it's impressive.
Okay.
And then people say, oh my goodness, AI reads the mind.
Yes, right.
But how confused can it be? Well, first of all, this is a bit of a trick. We've been able to do that for a while.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that we do this much, much better now. The second thing is waves out. An analog brain collects those waves. You register the waves of the brain, and this is basically translation from one code to another code to another code to another code.
Okay.
Of course, it's very lossy. You lose a lot, enormously, because from what was the actual sound to what we get through the vibration of our eardrums in the brain, and then what the brain is encoding in terms of these vibrations, then what comes out, you know that is Pink Floyd, because you know what came in.
Right.
You see what I mean? It's not like you could interpret that if you didn't know that was what came in.
Sure.
Anyway, so translation. And if you know how much neuroscience has done these days, that should not be surprising. But back to your question, therefore, are we talking about an analog or digital world? I think that as a Kantian, I find it a misplaced question. What we have is signals that come to the world, which we can encode as digital or analog, but we can switch all the time.
Mm.
Now, if you think that this is too fancy, remember that light is light, photons. Depending on the frame, they look like points or a wave.
Sure.
And asking whether light is a wave, no, continuous, or made of points, like bullets, means not having understood what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Because it is one or the other or both, depending on the interface that you put between you and the light.
Well, so the connection to the external mind thesis is look, I have a notebook, and these are all my thoughts about your work, and they are a guide for me to, it's like my active memory or something like that. And they seem like they're representations of my thoughts, but I'm wondering, are notes in a notebook, do they count as analog or digital? And I would think they would be digital, even though it sounds weird because we say it's an analog notebook, but it's not.
It really is a question of interpretation. Unless you ask what that question is for, mm-hmm. There is no way of answering it yes or no independently.
So Chalmers and Clark would say, perhaps, maybe our mind is extended out into the notebook because our thoughts are there. And they use, an example of an Alzheimer's patient who uses their notebook to guide themselves throughout the world. And they say, well, in a very real sense, this is, and I don't know how, with the sense they talk about, they don't say whether it's metaphorical or analogical or univocal, but they want you to think that this is like, the conclusion is that like, this is, your mind isn't just in your skull, it extends into your, wherever your thoughts go.
Yeah, no, I think the way I read it is a nice metaphor. Anything more than that, and I would be very critical. First of all, because I never seen, I never touch, I never sort of kick a mind. I mean, mind, if you start thinking of mind almost like a liquid in your brain that pours out and makes everything wet around you,
sure,
that's a bad idea.
Yeah.
We have a mental life. And for people who think that this is a bit strange, imagine someone saying, look, the world is made of objects and actions and properties of objects. So there are cars. Cars can be red can run. That's great. What is mental there? The mental, with the analogy, is how. So imagine, basically, the mental is an adverb. We don't have a mind. We live mindfully. Mm. If you have pass me this oversimplification, but if you have a adverbial idea of mind, and as in my case, you think that a second order ontology of that kind is really what matters, that things are not, they're not things and then property of things and then interactions between things, but actually they are relations that constitute things. Mm-hmm. Then there is mindfulness that gets, or living mindfully, that gets incarnated, if you like, in you, in me, or the new baby, or someone else. Then the picture is really almost upside down. And I find that philosophically more convincing, because it doesn't create a ontology of something like a mind out of thin air.
Yeah,
It's very dangerous. It's like imagine with a different analogy, which I hope is a bit more intuitive. I think it's the same story. I'm sorry. Democracy. Mm-hmm. I live in a democracy. Well, actually, you live in a house. This democracy thing? Oh, you live in a place where actions and interactions are democratic. Oh, you live democratically. Now I understand. Mm-hmm. Or someone runs quickly. Okay, where is the quickly? Point to, if you start looking at a thin base ontology, when in fact you're talking about ways and relational ways of not existing, the confusion leads to some kind of really funny things like, oh, my mind is out there, right? Mm-hmm. What I understand the metaphor, but it would be much more interesting to say that in a life lived mindfully, of course, I am the node at the center of this network. Mm-hmm. But the mindfulness, you know, is not just this node, it's all the relations that I have with the network.
Yeah.
So, final analogy. So, in case anyone thinks like this guy makes no sense whatsoever, it's like thinking in terms of roundabouts and or crossroads, if you prefer. Roundabouts is a very English word. Crossroads and roads. And ask people, what comes first? The crossroad or the road? They was like, oh, the roads. Crossroads is where the roads happen to be. I was like, well, that's my mind. My mind is a crossroad, is a roundabout, is where everything that interacts in a certain way, my past memories, my way of speaking English, my life, my experiences, my feelings, my current state of the body, all these relations, all these ways of being come together.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very concrete. I mean, don't cross the roundabout without stopping, checking, and going. It's totally concrete. But thinking in terms of first roundabouts, first the mind, and then a mindful sort of existence is to put the crossroads first and then build the roads to connect them.
Yeah.
Well, it makes no sense.
If we have a relational ontology, and I know that this is maybe going down a rabbit trail, but so we don't have to if you don't want to, but I have the substance ontologist folks in my head that they're saying, you know, a relation is a relation between things. So if you have a relation without things, it's like, what are we even talking about? And it's like the chicken and the egg.
Agreed. So here we need two steps.
Okay.
Well, first of all, there is a way, which not a two-step, there's a way of doing what's called structural realism in philosophy of science. Mm-hmm. And you can do that in an informational way that tries to solve both the chicken and the egg. But that is a bit visualized, and for the folks listening to this, just looking informational. Structural realism, and that's the role you can take.
We did a whole episode on that for folks interested.
There you go.
With Fantastic. Mint.
Precise. But let's keep it simple and straightforward on an everyday, not philosophy of science, but everyday experience. So you can really have two kinds here, at least two kinds of way of speaking about reality. One is I have access. Like I look, I check, maybe with tools, maybe with science, maybe with theory. But I have the means to tell you what the world is like.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Maybe improvable, but that possibility is open. The other one that says, look, forget about what is out there. What is out there is, you can see where I'm going, is sending signals to us. Yeah. What we get are the signals. The signals is what build our own ontology.
Uh-huh.
My ontology, which is this. Looking to you, this pen in my hand, is the result, the outcome of this particular receiver processing those particular signals so that this is the reality in which I am living. And it's completely real. I mean, the signals are real. Everything is concrete. I mean, I'm not going like, oh, there's no real reality. No, forget about it. We'll leave that to childish games and games played by philosophers. I'm talking about the real life, the life when you go to the grocery and come back. What kind of reality are we talking about? The metaphysical one, reality in itself, for the Kantians, the noumenon, or the outcome of my interactions with the world through this particular interface, epistemically speaking, that is my body, blah, 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 my culture and so on, my language, and the outcome of that. Call that ontology. Once you have that distinction, I'm getting to the chicken and egg.
This is really helpful.
The chicken and egg problem is for the metaphysician.
Uh-huh.
The metaphysician who wants to tell you what the world is in itself, independently of my or a human or a particular interface or anything, as if he had a God's eye perspective on the world, classic, it has to tell you what the foundational bits are and what comes first and what comes later. So roundabouts, things and their relations between things, nodes and relations. And they don't know. I mean, they've been running in circles because, of course, chicken and egg.
Because if we do take a Kantian picture, it's like, well, you're trying to escape your own mind, right? If you're going for transcendental ideas.
So you're also quoting your own language, your own categories.
But
in terms of trying to do metaphysics, try to do ontology, meaning, okay, how do we come up? What's the best model that we can get of this epistemic ontology that we have on our side? And here, the beauty of modeling something is that you can decide.
Yeah.
You can say, let's decide that we start modeling because it makes more sense, it's more fruitful, it's more explanatory. Anyway, let's decide that we start with lines, not with points.
Yeah.
And then you start on the whiteboard saying, okay, line, there's a relation. And the relation links A and B. I've just done it. Oh, you just got out of the chicken. Well, it's just saying, how do I want to model the relationship between egg and chicken? I'm going to start chronologically, make more sense, start with the egg and then the chicken.
Yeah.
Oh, but in real life, I'm not doing metaphysics. That's your problem, not mine.
So that's good.
The steps are epistemic ontology, not a metaphysical approach.
Yeah.
And on the epistemic ontology, realize that we have to model that epistemic ontology philosophically in order to understand it. And because in modeling, you're actually designing what you need,
yeah,
you can start wherever the heck you want.
Yeah. Well, I wonder, so some people want to take the epistemic ontology and then run it back into metaphysics and say, well, information is a neutral monism then, right? Because look at all the work we can do epistemically with information and these signals that we receive. So it looks like, let's just say that the noumenal realm just is information, right? Is that what's going on? What do you make of that project?
There is freedom, so to speak. So you can, to use Quine terminology, your ontological commitment can go much, much further and say, look, I have an epistemic ontology. It works very well. In fact, my epistemic ontology works so well that I can put robots on Mars. So that's a good, solid, not way of understanding the signal that the ultimate noumenal source is sending to me, interpreting them in the best way, such an extent they're successful, and therefore there's instrumental successfulness in my humanity. So in the way the human epistemic ontology works, totally fine. Do I have to say next step, and that's the way the world is? Well, if you like, but that is an act of faith. There's nothing that forces you to say that.
Okay.
I mean, you're welcome. but in a way, as any good scientist, scholar, philosopher, what we should do is to stay within what is guaranteed by our understanding.
Yeah.
If we want to say, of and above what we have reasons to believe that, there's so much more. So essentially is a friction-free commitment, like yes or not. I mean, is it anyone game? And we don't have to. We are free from. So normally a commitment is required. That's why. In this case, it would be just 100% volunteering an ontological commitment to something that is not required.
Yeah,
that makes sense. Can I do it? Yes, anytime.
Right.
Do I have to do it? Imagine the following thing: like is. The radio sends signals, sends music. I want to hear, I receive the music, I interpret the signals as music. I also want to believe that the signals represent the intrinsic nature of the radio. You are free to do that. Do they? It's unlikely. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. The radio sends signals. Now, someone will say, no, look, the radio is sending a specific kind of signals about its own nature. Well, that's an interesting thought. So maybe, but how do we know?
Yeah.
No.
Right.
And that is where my Kantian sort of breaks start going like red. Metaphysics. And there's nothing wrong with metaphysics. It's like storytelling. It's anyone's game. Enjoy. Go. Have fun. But then I read Tolkien and it's much better.
so final question for you. You've been so generous with your time here. This is for the audience. My audience loves simulation hypothesis, and I can see a connection here where someone might say, well, look, if we're, okay, so we go in for transcendental idealism of a certain stripe, and we're receiving these signals, and we can't say what the thing in itself is. Does that mean that we're living, in a simulation, even if not a computer simulation? Is the world that we see, the Lebenswelt, or the world for me, whatever terminology we used, ontology, the world of ontology, is that a simulated world? Just simulated by our own minds, maybe? Or
that's what gives a bad name to philosophy, unfortunately, this kind of discussions. And that's what gets philosophy departments closed down, eh? Because people think, oh, that's what you're doing. Okay, we don't need you.
Interesting.
But no, let me take it seriously for a moment.
Okay.
It's like saying, we live in a world full of ghosts. You can't touch them. You can't see them. In fact, you can't even prove that they are there, but they're there. Yes or no?
Right. Hmm.
What kind of question is that?
Hmm.
The premise undermines any possibility of providing a rational answer to the question.
Hmm.
Do we or do we not live in a simulation generated by the future? The premise undermines any possibility of a reasonable answer to the question.
Hmm.
So it's just a trick. It's one more trick that philosophers enjoy, but they should not play, or at least not publicly, because when society sees us wasting time after these silly things, then the judgment, no, we call for it, okay?
Hmm.
If that is what philosophy is, then people will ask, well, not with my taxpayer money. No, enjoy Saturday and Sunday, but we need something else. So let me put it in a different way. There are a lot of questions that we ask that I call them absolute questions, that provide, by being posed, no constraint whatsoever in terms of what could be the space of a reasonable answer.
Hmm.
If you have removed, by asking that question, any chance of providing an answer that makes any sense, well, why are you asking the first question in the first place? So sometimes, and that's where we took the wrong step. And with all these sort of experiments, simulation, and there's a confusion at the source.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the malicious demon confusion from Descartes onwards, at least, but also Plato, when he says the ring that makes you invisible.
Yeah.
So all these things, I mean, we're talking about Plato and Descartes. So were they just ridiculous people? Even Plato, no. What they were doing were thought experiments as means to an end.
Right.
They were not ends themselves.
Sure.
They were not asking, is it possible to be constantly deceived by a demon? Do I live or do I not live in a world in which a demon is creating all this? No, matrix, simulation, it's always the same story. No? A virtualizer. Descartes wasn't asking that stupid question because he was a genius. He was asking, how can I possibly test at the very end of the road in the most dramatic sense, like road test this car? What are the most extreme weather conditions for this car called human knowledge under which it will crack? And the most extremes are, imagine a demon. Can he even pass that test? He can, at least not Catino, Cognito, etc.
Sure.
Well, then I can drive that car even when a demon is around. I hope people are getting the analogy here.
Yeah, it's a great analogy.
But
yeah.
That was, basically, I think it was an engineer. We shouldn't forget.
Yeah.
So when he says, look, let me test this artifact that is human knowledge, putting so much pressure until it cracks, does it crack even when I go total blast? No, malicious demon. No, something remains.
Hmm.
The Cognito. Bingo. I can rebuild everything from there. Boom. Now, it's a class. We still read it because of that. But not because he was wondering, do I or do I not live in a world where malicious demon makes me think that I'm in front of the fire? Like, seriously? That is totally useless. Because if that is not the tool you're using to test the theory, but is actually the end of the game, then you're playing the wrong game.
Yeah,
that game is a waste of time. And that's what we started with. That is not a philosophical question. Mm-hmm. That is a philosopher's question. And no one cares at all about philosophers' questions. Mm-hmm. Everybody cares about philosophical questions.
Mm-hmm.
And the distinction, I hope, there's one message for this, keep this in mind. Am I asking a philosophical question or am I asking philosophers' questions?
Mm.
extended mind, virtual reality, simulation, AI taking over the world, that will leave no trace and will be in the chapter of how philosophy can be so embarrassing. No, thank you. Okay. There is no book like that that I want to see back in the end. Am I being not abrasive enough?
Yeah, it's so good. Dr. Flaherty, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much for all your time and letting me, you know, go through all these even philosopher questions. This has been great. Folks, that's going to have to do it for now. This has been Parker's Pensies.
Thank you.
And as always, all glory to God.